Welcome to Green and Red, scrappy politics for scrappy people, a regular podcast on radical environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Park.
Welcome to the Silky Smooth Sounds of the Green and Red podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott Parkin, in Berkeley, California. And as always, I'm joined by...
Bob Bazanko, and as always, for now, Houston, Texas.
And today, we're going to be talking about policing, often a hotly discussed topic, debated topic. We're joined by Michael Sierra Arevalo, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Texas at Austin. And his new and first book is The Danger Imperative, Violence, Death, and the Soul of Policing, which is out now. It's published now, correct?
It is. It's out now. Pick it up on Amazon, anywhere books are sold. DangerImperative.com.
Excellent. Well, Michael, welcome to the Green and Red podcast. Nice to have you
Thanks
here.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Maybe just to kind of kick off the kind of like interview, just to talk a little bit about what led you to this study. This is like a 300 page book. It includes, 1,000 hours on patrol, 100 interviews. A lot of work went into this study, but maybe actually talk a little bit about what led you to this study of policing.
So, for those that have not gone to graduate school, everybody has a plan when they start graduate school. And very often that plan goes in a very different direction once you start. And that was very much the story for me. I had applied to graduate school to study street gangs. I was really interested in things like violence at that time, but specifically community violence, street violence. And I was thinking about doing work related to violence prevention, which is what I actually got involved with when I first got to graduate school. And in the course of that work is when I met police officers in a non-enforcement context for the first time. And even during those early meetings, which were these sort of focus group style meetings called group audits, which are part of this broader strategy called focus deterrence, I was struck by how mundane they were, how normal they were. They were mostly white, and they were almost entirely men, and they had Celtic cross tattoos, and they clearly spent time on the bench press and what, but they reminded me of my conservative friends' dads growing up in Texas. They were not like all that special. They had a special job, but they were talking about things like overtime and vacation and the kid doing well in school or not well in school. And I was struck by how normal they seemed. I didn't know any officers at that time myself. But my focus was still very much on violence prevention and street violence until Michael Brown was killed in 2014 in Ferguson. And at that time, for listeners, this is years before the Washington Post put together The Counted, that now we take it for granted, this data set of the number of people that are fatally shot by police every year. This is years before other nonprofit outfits got on board to begin tracking these kinds of deaths. And I'm a grad student, and I just can't believe that we don't have a good estimate at the time of the number of people that are shot and killed by the police. It just makes no sense to me. I learned that we don't even have a really good estimate of how many officers there are. At the time, the census of law enforcement agencies was already a decade old. And so we're working with these really suspect figures from the FBI that are not required to be reported, that we know have lots of bias in them. And the questions that I'm forming at the time are very much about the how and the why of police violence. And so as a potentially naive grad student, I thought, I'm not going to answer these questions with surveys. The data doesn't seem very good, so I might as well get into a car. And so that's what I decided to do. I thought the best way to answer the question of the how and why of contemporary policing was to see the work up close. And that's when I got into a police car, and that's when I began talking to officers on patrol.
What were those rides like? I mean, were they kind of open to you? Were they skeptical or suspicious of you?
Most of the rides were pretty uneventful, which I think is surprising to some people. I will say that one thing that I think surprised me the most was about how boring a lot of police work actually is. It's a lot of driving around in circles, depending on the shift that you're on. If you're on certain shifts in certain parts of a city, you're just going from call to call to call to call, and it's very busy. As far as the officers themselves, though, it kind of ran the gamut. Some officers like very clearly wanted nothing to do with me. That said, even the most skeptical person finds it pretty hard to not say anything for 10 hours. And so, we would eventually get to have some part of a conversation about something. But some of them would retreat to boilerplate. It would be like talking to somebody that had memorized the general orders or the home webpage of the police department. But I think surprisingly enough, or maybe surprising to some listeners, most officers that I spoke to were very open with me about their work. Part of that was that I guaranteed anonymity. Part of that was driven by the fact that I don't even reveal the names of the department. So it's one thing to not name the officers, but as an added layer of protection for officers themselves, I decided not even to name the city. So I talk about Sunshine in the Southwest, West River on the West Coast, and Elmont on the East Coast. These are obviously not the real names of these cities. And this is all in an effort to provide an environment in which officers felt that, you know what, I can be honest or more honest, if not completely honest, with this person because they're not going to remain, they're not going to name the city or me. And many officers went so far as to express gratitude that somebody took the time to come and spend time in their world. They would talk about it in terms of forming my own opinion, as opposed to the sort of narrative that they had in their head of everybody forming their opinion about police through the lens of the hypercritical, untrustworthy media. I was taking the added steps of coming to observe their work directly, and some of them appreciated that.
Were they all rank and file, or did you actually also spend time with officers, sergeants, higher ranking officers?
So the vast majority of my time on patrol and generally in the departments, not all of my hours were in a police car, but the vast majority were with patrol officers. I did spend time with sergeants. Lieutenants were often my point of contact within any given police department. Lieutenants, of course, are one step above sergeants. Sergeants kind of run their squads. Lieutenants will be those who are in charge of a shift. They're often called the watch commander. I did interact with assistant chiefs, chiefs of police, but I never went on patrol with, for example, a chief of police. I would talk with them sometimes, often in early stages of gaining access to a field site to explain the project. But I was interested in how the 98% of sworn police officers think about the world, meaning those that are on patrol. Most officers will never even become sergeant. Most officers will start policing and end policing, pushing a black and white, answering calls for service. And so that's what I focus most of my time on.
You talked about how kind of mundane and routine it could be. And I think I would call it a myth, but we have this idea, and I think TV and media kind of perpetuates this, of the police kind of coming in and saving the day. You see this especially in TV shows. So could you just talk a little bit more about what's their actual routine like? Because if you look at data on what they actually do, I think they spend most of their time in terms of actual police functions, like giving out traffic tickets or something like that. What kind of stuff did you see, contrary to kind of the Hollywood, the fantastic images we'll see in media of it, of their day?
Sure. So I saw very few tickets. So it wasn't that. That's not what I was watching or seeing. And in fact, most officers that I spent time with were pretty loath to cut parking tickets. Both out of a desire not to like ruin somebody's day for an infraction they don't actually care about. No officer, I say no officer. Most officers don't actually care about broken taillights. Those are all just those are methods to have a legal stop to then engage in the practice of building your reasonable suspicion for something else. If they did give out tickets, it was usually for serious infractions, or they were traffic cops, like motorcycle cops, and that's their whole job is to give out tickets. No, I think the way that I describe it is that in contrast to policing media, so this would be, television shows, whether it be, I'm dating myself, but The Shield, or other police procedurals, line level officers are not cracking cases. Really, they're mostly there to record information. So they rarely encounter, particularly a violent crime, in progress. They're usually responding if there is violence, which is rare in the scheme of policing. They're getting there after the fact. They are there to be first responders if there is somebody hurt. They're there to close down a scene if there's been a shooting, preserve evidence, find witnesses, knock on doors. Again, they're essentially gathering the raw material that might down the line inform a police investigation. And that's a big might. most of what they're actually doing is dealing with low-level disputes of some kind. And that's such a wide category of things. It can be arguments between roommates. It can be arguments between neighbors over where the trash cans are. It can be between the customer and then the cashier at a gas station, or a waitress and a patron at a restaurant. These are all things that I've seen. And usually it's not entirely clear why the police are the ones that are needed, but they're the ones that have been called and they have to do something about whatever is going on there. It's not to say that officers don't intervene in emergencies. It's not that they don't get involved in shootings with an armed criminal. I never saw it, and it's very rare in the grand scheme of policing. Most of
Yeah.
what officers do is essentially armed social work.
Well, no, that's kind of what I was asking for because, if you watch, especially like in movies or TV, or even if you hear the rhetoric of somebody like Trump, police are just always 100% of the time in these really tense situations, somebody's trying to hurt them. And I think, and I've seen data before that suggests like most of their day is involved in the kind of things you just described, which is really routine and not in the grand scheme of things all that dangerous either. So,
And
I think.
paperwork. Yeah,
Yeah,
they never
and
show the
paperwork. Yeah.
paperwork on TV.
Yeah. I mean, I think, the word propaganda, I think, really fits in a lot of ways on that issue where, the way the media presents us or the way Hollywood presents it or TV shows present it really gives us this, I think, mythological idea of what they're doing all day.
To that point, and also kind of getting to a little bit of what you talk about in the book, even the title of the book is the danger imperative. In the, in the beginning, you talk about actually how the most important thing taught at police academies is survival. There's this police culture of officer safety. I'm wondering if you could actually talk a little bit about that. Pretty fascinated with like the culture of policing, where, like to consider ourselves students of institutions. And so, could you talk a little bit about the danger imperative?
Sure. So the danger imperative is an example of what social scientists refer to as a cultural frame, which is essentially a fancy way of saying a filter. And we all have various filters that we wear in different parts of our lives. So my job as a faculty member at university, I employ a particular frame when I'm at work and when I'm doing work. I interpret stimuli out in the world in a particular way, and I pay attention to certain things while minimizing my attention to others when I'm in that particular frame of mind, when I have that particular filter on. Maybe I change that out when I'm spending time with my friends at jujitsu or when I'm spending time with other groups of people. You operate through different frames. We all have them. Police, by extension, also have a particular frame. And this frame is what I call the danger imperative, which centers on the preoccupation with violence and the necessity of ensuring officer safety at all times. And now, this frame is something that, instead of what some people have described in prior research as a sort of downloaded manual for operating like a robot might download some software and suddenly they are, I'm a police officer. Suddenly I have the danger imperative. It might begin in the academy, but keep in mind, the academy is the shortest part of an officer's career. It's about 6 months. And so if you spend 10, 15, 20, 25 years on patrol, that 6 months is a drop in the bucket. So the danger imperative might begin there formally, but it's actually something that is recreated. It's amplified every day that an officer's on patrol. It happens in their lineup meetings. It happens at in-service training, which they take periodically to keep their certification as a law enforcement officer in their state. It's something that is recreated in the media that they consume, and then it's recreated on patrol as they perform as an officer that is seeing their work through the danger imperative and this preoccupation with violence, and seeing other officers perform their work through that exact same frame. So it becomes this self-reinforcing process wherein the frame encourages certain kinds of perception and certain kinds of behavior. And as those behaviors and modes of perceiving the world are recreated through officers, you end up recreating the frame and becomes this cycle of behavior and culture.
Is that kind of widespread, that danger imperative? Because, I think you're talking about kind of it would seem to me kind of almost conflicting ideas where they're constantly thinking about danger and, whether they're going to either use violence or see violence used against them. At the same time, as you just said, much of their day is writing tickets and filling out paperwork. So are they being given this kind of exaggerated idea of the danger out there and they're kind of internalizing it and looking for it? Or is it, I mean, how does that actually work?
So I heard two questions there. One is this pervasive? And the second is there a mismatch between sort of discussed probability versus the real probability? So on the first one, as a responsible social scientist, I only spent time in three departments. That said, I have not seen evidence of a department in which this doesn't exist. Now, it may very well be the case. I only looked at three urban departments in the years 2014 through 2018. It might very well be the case that a department in a rural part of the country, or maybe a suburban part of the country, just has a radically different way of viewing the work. Anecdotally, from either colleagues or friends that either are police officers, have interacted with police officers, or been to community meetings, including in very safe suburbs, they talk about the guy who shows up with his pants tucked into his combat boots and talks about like the danger of this suburb in New Jersey. My suspicion is that this is more of a spectrum story. It's not a binary state. So some departments are going to be real far on the danger imperative spectrum, and some are going to be less far. But I am skeptical that there exists a department in contemporary U.S. policing in which officers do not believe that safety is paramount, and they must take steps on every patrol during the interactions in which they engage to maintain and ensure their survival. And I'm willing to go on a limb, and I'm happy to be convinced otherwise, but that is my professional opinion.
Just a quick oh.
Yeah, no, please go ahead.
No, and I don't know if you can like it, 'cause you promised anonymity, but can you give us some idea of kind of the size of these cities that you studied even, or
Sure. So
just
I think Elmont at the time was around 125, 130,000. And then I think West River and Sunshine were approximately the same size population. I don't actually remember. I need to look. I should probably know that table off the top of my head. I know the size of the departments themselves varied. So the largest department by size was Sunshine. I believe that was somewhere in the neighborhood of 800, 900 sworn. And then West River is sitting around 500, 600 sworn. So these are not mega cities, so I can say confidently that it's not the New York Police Department.
That's kind of what I was, because then you
Sure.
would see a difference, wouldn't you? Like New York cops, Chicago cops, Detroit cops versus kind of middle with smaller city.
I don't know, but I don't think so.
Oh, yeah.
I think that you can see evidence. I know Minneapolis, for example, there was discussion after the Philando Castile shooting. Well, and I talk about this in the book, where Geronimo Yanez, the officer that killed Castile, was found to have gone to, I believe it was the Bulletproof Warrior or Bulletproof Mind seminar that was put on by, or that's associated with the pedagogy of one Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman. Minneapolis is a major city. And I think even if you're not looking at the specific training components, when you look at the rhetoric around officer shootings and uses of force, you hear the same sorts of justifications. I was in fear for my life. It was for my safety. And those are patterns that I saw clearly in the departments that I was in. And that's in part because all departments abide by the Fourth Amendment, or their policies are informed by the Fourth Amendment. So they are all, to some degree, playing by the same rules, at least when we think about the constitutional law that sets constraints on how officers use force. So it would make some sense that there would be similarities, broadly speaking. But again, in all candor and to be a responsible sociologist, no, I did not observe the Chicago Police Department. But even my own colleague, Samantha Simon, her new book, Before the Badge, she looked at four different academies in the Southwest. None of them were my academies. And we might as well have been observing the same stuff, very similar behaviors, very similar sorts of cultural understandings of what police work is. And your second question, I believe, was about the exaggerated nature. This, I think, is one of the stickier parts of the danger imperative. So the first is, I'm not saying that officers shouldn't be concerned with their safety. It turns out that two things can be true at the same time. One is that policing is dangerous. It is dangerous. It's way more dangerous than our jobs, that's for sure. You are far more likely to be assaulted as a police officer with hands or fists, or to be shot than other professions. That is true, and it's an empirical fact. And these sort of simplistic, pointing very simplistically at, well, but they don't die as often. Like, that's true, but they also have like bulletproof vests. And so just counting fatalities kind of is, it's missing the full totality of what constitutes danger and violence. And the second is that it can still be rare. It turns out dangerous and rare can exist side by side. And I think that that is where police culture and socialization miss the empirical reality, which is that it is true that it is a dangerous job, particularly compared to other jobs. But one estimate, I think it's Jordan Blair Woods had a paper come out using Florida traffic stop data. The risk of being killed in a traffic stop is something like 1 in 65 million. But that's certainly not how it's discussed in policing. Instead, they rely on rhetoric that is, to give them their credit, like it's like in a mathematical sense, technically true, which is that it's non-zero. And again, like that is, that's true. It's non-zero. It's pretty close to zero, but it's non-zero. And so that allows you to begin to build a very cohesive worldview, which is that because it is non-zero, any steps that I can take within the law to preserve my safety and mitigate the possibility of going home in a casket, why would I not take those steps? And that becomes a very slippery slope to the infringement of individual rights.
And I'd be curious about how race in particular, because that's a lot of the sort of popular dialogue, at least within spaces on the left, for example, is that like there's killer cops and they target young Black men. But I'd be curious about how race fits into their sort of culture and their rhetoric around this safety and survival issue.
I think that the role of race in my own field work was most obvious in its absence in how they discuss things. And so this is something that's very similar to work done by Eduardo Bonilla Silva at Duke. And he talks about colorblind racism. And so this is a way of talking about race that either denies the salience of race in racial inequality or naturalizes it, it finds excuses for it. And so police officers, if they talked about race, it was usually to deny that it had anything to do with how policing happens. It would often be like, I have never seen that in this department. That might be a problem in some departments. They would often rely on rhetoric about a few bad apples. These are all things that you see just in media generally as ways of explaining away very persistent, very stark disparities in all sorts of police outcomes, whether it be stops, arrests, uses of force, et cetera. The way that I think about race operating within the danger imperative is that the danger imperative is a prism, and it very, very concertedly makes no mention of race. And so, in the training documents that I reviewed, for example, in Chapter One, Survival School, there is no mention of race whatsoever. All of the language is around these aseptic, formally aracial concepts like threat, weapons, safety. None of that is inherently racialized. We know, of course, that there are pervasive and very ingrained assumptions about who is threatening and who is likely to be criminal and who is likely to be violent. Specifically, it's young Black and Latino men are perceived to be these things. And we have strong empirical evidence that these conceptions exist out in the world, not just among police, to be clear, but in the general public. So the danger imperative, in fact, doesn't need to mention race. It becomes a prism through which those things can operate. But I think an important point here is that I don't actually present evidence in the book of overt racist cops beating on Black and brown kids because I didn't see those things happen. But what's important to recognize is that I present the thought experiment like this. Imagine a world where I actually had a perfect filtering mechanism and I could get rid of all the quote unquote racist cops. So I now have a perfectly egalitarian police department, essentially robots, right? I essentially remove discretion through filtering, and there's no more ability for officers to be explicitly biased against people of color. It turns out that even if that were the case, I have fixed nothing else about the system in which policing operates. Now we're talking about structural racism. So I didn't fix redlining, I didn't fix failing schools, I didn't fix food deserts, I didn't fix economic inequality. And so with that system arranged as it is, even if I assume the officers are themselves perfectly egalitarian, if they're operating through the danger imperative and the broader arrangement of social institutions in the socio-political context stays the same, I am still going to systematically funnel police officers into places that generate more calls for service because crime and violence are driven by structural conditions. And so behavior that is shaped by the danger imperative, whether it be legal or constitutional uses of force or mistakes, are all going to be concentrated in the same places, namely poor minority communities. Now, that's the thought experiment. We know that biases exist. We know that those things operate. And the danger imperative is a filter, it's a prism for those biases to manifest, but it doesn't depend on racial animus, which, in my opinion, is a scarier story.
You are listening to the Silky Smooth Sounds of the Green and Red podcast. Please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you're watching this on YouTube, please hit that subscribe button. And if you're listening to us on your favorite audio platform, please give us a rate and review. It helps us with the algorithms. And if you really like what you're hearing, please go to our Patreon, patreon.com/greenredpodcast, and become a patron or make a one-time donation by going to our website at greenandredpodcast.org and hitting that support button.
Within that context, right? So they have this danger of paradigm, and they're not showing you any kind of overt biases, especially with regard to race. Cause, you know, especially I think in the circle, Scott and I, and perhaps you inhabit, race and policing is kind of the issue. And often nothing else is brought up. But I grew up in a union household, so I saw cops like going after strikers and arresting people on strike, mm-hmm. and, you know, in the area where I grew up. And in the summer of 2020, we saw police attacking, you know, moms in Portland and medics and journalists and things like that. So do the police kind of, do they genuinely think that they're like kind of saving society from chaos? Or is there some understanding that they're protecting ruling class interests? That's my rhetoric. So do they, is there any sense that they understand that they have this, you know, kind of social role to play? That it's not just like, you know, all about like protection from bad people.
Yeah. So unsurprisingly, they do not conceive of themselves as protecting the interests of the ruling class.
Right.
No, I think much more common is a simplified sense that they are standing between order and chaos. I think at its best, officers really do believe that they are there to help people that can't help themselves. That there are bad people, their words not mine, bad people in the world, that there's evil in the world, and that they have the ability in usually small ways, but sometimes very meaningful ways, to help somebody. It can be something as simple as changing an old lady's car tire, something I did with an officer. It can be finding a bicycle that was stolen. It can be filing the police report that allows somebody to finally file an order of protection and get away from an abuser. They perceive, I believe correctly, that they have the means to help people in some cases. That said, far more often than grandiose ideas of, you know, we're protecting the little guy and we are standing up against evil, which I did hear both of those. I heard both of that, both pieces of rhetoric. I think that you spend enough time on patrol and you begin to realize that you're really just there to, you're there to mitigate disputes and to try and keep the peace. That's really what you're doing. So even in the context of things like protests, which officers do periodically, that's not that common. They sometimes do it and, you know, they complain because it's often mandatory overtime. So they lose their days off and they got to wear the cap and the armor. And it's like, it's a pain and people are like really mean to the cops. And sometimes they throw things at them. And it's like, it's not fun. But that's not what they do most of the time. And so I think much more commonly, police do what lots of workers do, which is they find a way to understand their work is valuable and to find a sense of self-esteem in the work. There's phenomenal, it's now decades old, but it still holds up. It's Everett C. Hughes, Men and Their Work. And when particularly you engage in what he describes as dirty work, he talks about garbage men in this regard. You have to find a way to make sense of what you do as valuable and lauded. Now, obviously, police officers occupy a much more prestigious position in society than garbage workers. They get far more resources. They get far more legal protections. But officers very much engage in the same practices of trying to find a positive spin on what it is they do.
One thing I'm kind of curious about, because you said you did your study between 2014 and 2018. You know, in 2016, I believe in the 2016, there was a big flare up around Black Lives Matter. Was that when Philando Castile was killed in 2016, or was that earlier?
Yeah, it would have been just before. Yeah, it would have been Philando Castile, Alton Sterling, and then the Dallas incident happened.
Yeah, and this my question is going to be around the Dallas incident, and I believe there's another one in like Shreveport or Baton Rouge as well, where the police officers were sort of targeted and shot and some were killed, and I'm kind of curious how incidents like that, especially those in particular, but I think there was also one around a former Los Angeles Police Department and military officer who also killed some police, but I'm kind of curious about how incidents.
Chris Norton, or
Chris Dornan, who how incidents like that sort of inform this. Is that a sort of like a narrative in which they sort of like keep and help perpetuate?
Yeah, incidents like Dallas, that was the most obvious and overt one. But even before that, the assassination of Wen Jianlu and Rafael Ramos in Brooklyn at the end of 2014, I believe. So it was December 2014. A man that was angered by the police killings of Michael Brown and Alton Sterling went from Baltimore to New York and just shot both officers point blank in the head while they were sitting in a patrol car, went to the subway station and killed themselves as the NYPD closed in. And even after that incident, Patrick Lynch, the president of the PBA in New York, the Police Benevolent Association, he came out and said, that this is essentially the product of protesters and sympathetic liberal politicians run amok. And then there's this like kind of ominous memo that goes out, which says that we are now, for the first time in a long time, a wartime police department. And so this is tied into the rhetoric around the war on cops, which I talk about extensively at the front end of the book, as sort of a framing for the empirical question at hand. And so the rhetoric of the war on cops never makes any concrete claims as to what exactly would constitute a war. It's kind of this amorphous thing. It's a mixture of political attacks and legal attacks and also physical violent attacks, and they all feed on each other. And so you're able to rhetorically point to any one incident and say, aha, see, the war is real. Violence is skyrocketing. It's blood in the streets. It's mayhem. And this is all because of the libs and bail reform and whatever else you want to sort of like wrap
Defund the
into.
police.
Yeah. And like years before, right? So the war on cops narrative, I think, originated in its current form now, close to a decade ago. But it's an evergreen political strategy. The incident in Dallas when I was in the field quickly became a flashpoint. It became incontrovertible evidence that the war on cops is very real. And 2016 did see a spike, largely driven by the incident in Dallas, in terms of the overall count nationwide, of rising violence against police. They don't talk about how like the next year was a decrease and the year before that was relatively low as well, but this was something that was most obvious in, I talk about this in chapter two, Ghosts of the Fallen, which is how individual officer deaths are used by departments across the country to sort of link themselves to a shared occupational understanding of police work as being something that is profoundly dangerous. And so, despite the fact that the officers in Sunshine, where I was at the time, had no tangible connection to the officers that were murdered in Dallas, departments across the country sent contingents of officers to the funerals in Dallas. Officers that went from Sunshine brought back patches. They brought back funeral pamphlets, displayed them in the office. When officers across the country are killed, it's not uncommon to see officers on clear other side of the US wearing black mourning bands across their badges. That can be for local officers. It can also be for officers on the other side of the country. And the underlying rhetoric and the utility of these symbols is to essentially recreate the assumption that a threat to an officer anywhere is a threat to an officer everywhere. And it allows you as an officer to connect yourself not only to the fate of the city or the town that you patrol in, but you can suddenly begin to include yourself in a much broader, much more dire narrative about you're protecting the nation. You are what stands between the forces of evil and chaos, whether that be cartels on the border or MS-13 on the East Coast or Al-Qaeda. You are a police officer and you are the front line that is defending us, the sheep, from the wolves out there because you are the sheepdog.
And how do you think that narrative fits in with something like January 6th, where we saw, largely white right-wing Trump supporters attacking police officers at the Capitol? Is that a deviation, or would you say that also falls into the thin blue line holding the line against the agents of chaos?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. Obviously, I wasn't in the field when those things happened, so I haven't had conversations with officers about how that fits into a sense of who is threatening the us and who the them are. Traditionally speaking, the them is usually poor people of color, but it's also included students, as you mentioned, right? It can be student protesters. It can be
anti-fascists.
99%. Like, so it's not just black and brown people, but whenever meets road, it's usually black and brown people who are the ones that are meeting the most forceful response from the police. I don't know. I do think that some people clearly see the, we'll just generously call it irony, of flying a thin blue line flag in the crowd and then beating police with flagpoles and fire extinguishers. You know, police tend to be conservative. I don't know how far the fracturing of the conservative movement has reached into policing. It may very well be the case that police officers find some way to reconcile the targeting of police officers, the Capitol Police, on that day as something that is either justified because they believe that, again, the election was stolen or whatever else, or they perhaps justify it as it's just a few bad apples. Like, that's not most conservatives. These are just like some yahoos that got out of hand. I honestly don't know.
It's just a rowdy tour of the Capitol, I think.
Yeah. I mean, after all, they can't all get in through windows.
Yeah, exactly. And there were actually also active duty police, which are actually part of the riot, on the riot side,
yeah,
too.
100%. Yeah, absolutely. There's active duty military, active duty police, retired police.
A couple of years ago, I saw an article. I don't remember who the researcher was, but said that, you know, we have this issue. He considered it a problem in police forces attack people. But he said sheriff departments are actually much worse, especially in rural areas. And I wondered if you looked into, or if, you know, I know you didn't, if you didn't ride with them, but if you're aware of that kind of literature, because I got the sense from this that there are, you know, like in certain areas, it's much worse. And I think they feel kind of more emboldened in attacking people or using violent solutions. And there are, you know, there's even less risk of any consequence for it in among sheriffs in certain geographical areas rather than, you know, kind of city police forces.
Mm. So I can't paint with too broad a brush. That said, there's very obvious differences between sheriff's departments and police. You know, for listeners that are less familiar, the most obvious difference is that sheriffs are elected, and they don't have the same sort of accountability structure as a city police officer or police chief specifically. So in a major city, you know, police chief is usually appointed, and then they report to the city manager. There are often commissions, there's oversight. They're pretty toothless, but there is some sort of oversight. That's not how it operates in a sheriff's department. And you can be a sheriff for a long time. And so even just that as a difference, the formal accountability structures that exist in cities are less likely to be replicated for something like a sheriff's department. There are going to be obvious exceptions. You know, Los Angeles Sheriff's Department is going to have more oversight than the average sheriff's department. But I can't speak too much about sheriffs. I didn't study sheriffs. That said, it was most obvious in my West Coast department. So that was a city that was experiencing protests around the time that I was there. And they said, like, we have general orders and like we're pretty restricted in what we can do with protesters. This is in part because there had been some egregious misuses of force during Occupy Wall Street years before. And so like in cities across the country, Seattle, other places, they had changed some policies in response to tear gas and all kinds of stuff that was used. And so like, yeah, ever since that, our policies are super restrictive. Like we are not supposed to like chase people, do all kinds of stuff. They said that, yeah, but if the county shows up, like they don't play by the same rules that we play. They have a different use of force policy. And so the rhetoric was very much that either the highway patrol or the state troopers county officers, sheriffs, deputies, that they were more likely to not be as constrained in their ability to use violence when interacting with the public. I didn't review documents or training docs or other kinds of data to corroborate that, but that was the view of officers themselves in my Western site.
Now, you know, it's kind of, I think, expected to some degree to see the cops kind of play up this danger. And if somebody is a policeman's killed on the other side of the country. They kind of, internalize it and personalize it. I don't know if you studied this, but it seems like the media has a major role in this too, because the media often portrays, like, kind of creates reality, right? They'll say, like, police are under siege or police are being attacked. And even if there's not the data to back it up, I mean, did you look into that at all, the way the kind of media kind of embellishes or maybe extends out these ideas about cops being under danger, or this war on cops or something like that?
It's certainly the case that the media has a part to play here. I think what is more likely happening here is, and this is a, you know, I think increasingly people are getting wise to the fact that far too many local journalists in particular are essentially police stenographers, and they just take a police press release as fact and just kind of run with it. So part of it is that the police themselves, when they have, you know, a PIO or a public information officer, they are reproducing things that upon later scrutiny or more investigation turn out to not be true. I think the most obvious example is the murder of George Floyd. Like, that initial press release, had we not had cell phone footage, it's entirely likely that that case would just have never come to light. So I think that that is something that the police themselves do, but then the media then takes that and runs with it, right? So that either exonerates police sort of preemptively, something like, police fired a shot and somebody was killed by a bullet, like that kind of like odd rhetoric where the police didn't do anything, something that the media does. But even when it comes to officers who were shot, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, doesn't specify who needs to be bleeding. If an officer is shot, that's newsworthy. And if somebody is shot by the police, that's newsworthy. And this is not my area of expertise, but as somebody that simply consumes media and sees media, the ability to foment anger or to foment fear, I don't really care how you vote as long as you're clicking, if I'm a news organization. And so if you are able to play up the existence of a war, either very, very literally by talking about the war, or simply portraying these ultimately rare incidents as something that is happening more and more, that you don't even need to say it. You just publish the story. You just don't put the context to it, and people fill in the blanks. I think, again, being cynical about it, I think that media, regardless of its seeming political bent, whether it be MSNBC or Fox News, I think they're all in the business of news. They're all looking to make money. And again, if it bleeds, it leads. It doesn't really matter who got shot.
Yeah, I was also thinking about, like, the Washington Post cut loose Radley Balko, who used to extensively cover police violence or police attacks. And, you know, the Post got rid of him. And I just kind of was curious, because that's kind of the most overt example, right? This guy is, like, always writing about these issues. And so the Post got rid of him. They said that he's writing long articles and he's using the Marshall Project. And they said they wanted more hot takes rather than his reasoned, you know, articles about the police. So I was just kind of curious. It seems to me, just as a consumer of media, that it's really important that the role the media plays is really important in kind of getting these ideas out about the police being under siege, the police being at war. You know, we're in this state of nature and they're the thin blue line, right? Just that's kind of what I was getting at. So,
I see. Yeah, I don't know why Radley got cut. Big fan of his work. You know, Warrior Cops on the Shelf, cited all the time.
Yeah. No, it's great stuff. He has a Substack now, I think. So.
Speaking about media and then other things that feed into that, and just thinking about right-wing media ecosystems, which, very much promote this sort of notion of the war on cops. I think Trump last week actually went to the funeral of a New York police officer who was slain in the line of duty, which Trump, to me, is a big promoter of this notion of the war on cops. And I'm wondering, particularly with, you know, some of the officers in which you talked with, how, I mean, I know everyone's influenced by media at some level. I'm wondering how much, you know, some of the officers you talked with were sort of like really much in that sort of influence sphere.
Yeah. I mean, if I could do the whole project over again, I think I would ask much more pointed questions about where they consume news. Most of the officers that I spoke to that mentioned the news at all would make claims like, I don't even watch the news anymore. It's like, it's just like, part of it was they didn't want to be consuming media that was critical of the police. That was part of it. And then the other part was something that I I'm right there with them. It's like, look, man, like I got enough going on in my life. There's enough negative stuff around. I'm not looking to go home after work and, just like bathe my eyeballs in more negative stuff. And so most of them would claim that they just weren't consuming much media at all. That said, if you're in a police department, if the TV's on, it's probably a coin flip, but I only ever saw Fox News. They were not watching MSNBC, I'll tell you that, when I did see that it was on. You'll see printouts of various stories. They're usually from conservative outlets. I saw op-eds by folks like Heather McDonald, who's the author of the book, The War on Cops, Thomas Sowell, the conservative black economist. What else did I see? I saw articles from Police One, which was bought by Lexapol a few years ago. Lexapol is also this for-profit company that standardizes police policies now. So most departments, big departments in particular, because the legal landscape changes and it's actually quite expensive to write custom policies, they contract this out to Lexapol. Lexapol takes care of writing policies for you, and the idea is that they guarantee that it will be within the law. They bought Police One, which also provides online training. And essentially, it's media by cops for cops. But there's a whole parallel media sphere for police. And if you want to get a sense of like, they vary in the intensity of their political valence. And so they're all lean conservative, but like Police One is a shadow of how intense it gets on like law officer. Law officer is like a conservative fever swamp. It is Breitbart, but cops. It is something completely separate. And that is something separate from online Facebook groups or Instagram posts, where you have any range of opinions, people posting as officers, and it's not clear who's who. There's been some reporting out of Philadelphia on private police Facebook groups, and it's just like an awful stew of racism and misogyny and xenophobia. And so there is this mixture of sort of informal media, parallel media, and then the biggest media. We talk about Fox News, but then you have like InfoWars, and I don't have a good sense of how much of which outlet officers are watching. But even if you look at the most mainstream media, Police One or Law Officer, these are outlets that very much recreate the danger imperative. They usually have dedicated sections to officer survival, dedicated sections to the top story of an officer that was killed in the line of duty or shot in the line of duty or run over by this or stabbed by here. These are perpetual stories. And I get the newsletters from Police One, so like I get the emails every day. There's usually a story of some act of violence against police. This is a pervasive phenomenon that media, whether it be formal or less mainstream, is certainly perpetuating.
I don't know if you saw the tweet last week. I think it's a politician from New York who maybe even an ex-congressman, but at the funeral for that officer that Trump spoke at, there's this massive photo, just like the streets lined with police cars and motorcycles. And I forget what the tweet, the specific words were, but it's basically a threat, like, we're coming for you, don't you ever cross us, that kind of thing. I mean, and it's not that uncommon, where the rhetoric, especially from like police union officers and things like that. Did you get a sense of that where, they were just kind of almost like in this tweet and other incidents like that, they're kind of gearing up, almost looking for a fight, And I know you were in smaller departments, but do you have any sense of that they're kind of looking for kind of, aggression or something like that?
What do you mean by looking for aggression?
Well, like they're kind of threatening people, like, cross us and see what happens. They're kind of like girding up for battle almost, because I've seen this a
No.
lot, like, okay, because you'll see that a lot with like police union. I think officials are really, like, we're going to get them and they're coming after us. And, it kind of sounds like Al Capone in a lot of ways. So I'm just curious.
Sure. No, I mean, I will say that the rhetoric from official New York Police Department administrators, that stands out to me, because you're right. When I do see that rhetoric, it's usually from like the usual suspects. It's from the president or the vice president of the Fraternal Order of Police, like the national office, or it's lodge level stuff. Chicago had a particularly vicious POA president for a while, like around pandemic era. And you'll see it coming from like their individual lodge accounts. But usually, and again, that's why New York kind of stands out, that you have these high profile police administrators making claims about like this is misinformation, and like, that is, in my experience, kind of just being on Twitter and keeping a finger on the pulse of police administrators and what they say online, like that stood out. Other examples are like Alex Villanueva at the in LASD, when he was still the sheriff. That stood out. He was a particularly combative sheriff, both publicly and on his social media. You get others, you know, who kind of rise to prominence. He's an American constitutionalist sheriff. Lamb, for example, is pretty prominently out there. He's like firmly ensconced in the culture wars, war on cops, pro-MAGA, that kind of thing.
Clark in Milwaukee was like that too.
Yeah, Clark in Milwaukee had
And the
his whole
guy
thing
from
going. His
Minneapolis, I
fake
can't remember
fins.
his name. Yeah.
Yeah, Minneapolis. Yeah, so I mean, so sometimes they are themselves. And again, you'll notice those are two sheriffs. And so, like, sheriffs do not behave the same way on social media by and large as police chiefs of major cities, again, in my experience. But yeah, I didn't see overt examples like that. The rhetoric from officers was not like, oh, come get some. That wasn't what was happening. And they probably shouldn't be. You probably wouldn't tell me that if you were going to say it. But again, I think a lot of this is political posturing. I think the people that feel empowered to say that tend to be very high up in the department, frankly, and they're saying those things. So they don't think anything is going to happen, and they can. I was not getting that kind of rhetoric from line level officers. They mostly, again, it's mostly just people doing a job. And again, the way I describe in the book, like there are consequences to people just doing their job. But the story is not a story of monsters. It's a story of men in systems.
I only really have one more question, Scott. So I don't know if you
I only have one other question as well.
Okay. Mine is just kind of more kind of contemporary, and it's not really the topic of the subject of your book, but it's something I suspect you thought about. New York recently deployed a huge number of cops to guard the subways, and there has been some violence in the subways. A lot of this is about fare jumping as well. But even since the cops have been deployed, there have been like I think three murders on the subway with them there. So, do you know, are you aware of any research on like just actually if their presence really makes that much of a difference? Because, kind of, you know, we see this a lot where you see these massive displays of police presence or firepower even, but the kind of problems persist. And is that just kind of political posturing to say, hey, we're with the cops and we support the blue, or is there actually any evidence that these things matter? Because like in New York, it seems like it hasn't. And you know, that, like I said, these crimes have persisted, and it's created even more, I think, aggression. I know a lot of people are pissed off about it. Just kind of wonder if there's anything on that.
So I don't know of any specific evaluation of subway surges. That's what we're talking about here, is not like a macro level surge. It's about specifically cops on the subways. That said, we do have evidence that suggests when you increase the number of officers, and I believe the study was done in New York. This is by some folks at Penn. Aaron Chalfin is one of the authors of the study. And they find that when you increase officers, you do reduce. It's a relatively small reduction, but you do reduce homicides while also increasing arrests for like low-level crimes, and those things disproportionately concentrate on racial minorities, which is like a story that I think accords with what you would expect. Like, there's going to be some effect, maybe, and then yeah, there's also going to be some negative effects. I think it's actually kind of what you would expect, and I think the question is the juice worth the squeeze? Is the infringement on liberty, is the intrusion of police into the daily lives of people worth it? And frankly, like, I'll leave that question to the economists who want to put dollar amounts on like human lives and lost income and whatever else. I do think that the story in New York, New York is a high profile city, for better and for worse. New York leads the way on a lot of innovation and a lot of policy, same as LA and Chicago, these big cities that move the needle on conversations. There was a phenomenal interview on The Breakfast Club. I don't know if you caught it, between Mayor Eric Adams, former NYPD officer and a public defender in the city. I believe her name is Oluyemi Oluren. And she came with receipts. And she said, you have been fear-mongering about crime in New York since you've been elected. You brought back these aggressive police units, which were disbanded. You brought them back. The federal monitor said that they are stopping disproportionately, something like 97% Black and Latino people. And then at the same time, you're saying that it's the safest city in the country. So which is it? Is this an unprecedentedly safe city, or is crime out of control and we need more cops in the subways? Like, you can't really have it both ways. I do think that my general read on the situation is that flooding the subway with cops is a really expensive way to make people feel safe, which is fundamentally what this is about. It's not because the subway is awash in bodies and blood. It's because people are scared. And that's a real thing. And politicians are responsive to feelings of insecurity. I think the thing that's tough to swallow is that if you're the one stoking the insecurity, and then you're going to come into our pockets to pay for more cops who we see on their phones and who do not seem to be directly contributing to increases in safety, that's when I think people get a little bit upset. And I think it's what Oleyemi was pointing to, this sort of this lack of consistency in how you're talking about the problem and its solutions.
You mentioned the money angle, and this was a while back, not that long ago, but I saw an article that said that New York was spending about $155 million on this kind of enhanced subway protection, and fare jumping, which is a big part of this, was costing the city about $4 million annually. So they're essentially losing $150 million to stop fare jumpers.
My last question, actually, we had kind of touched on police unions and union officials, and going back to your study. One, we're living in a period where we're seeing at least something of a resurgent labor movement, and everybody who has a job has some resentment towards their boss. And I'm kind of curious about the sort of the how pro union some of the officers you talked with were. What their feelings were about their own relationship with like the management versus rank and file, and how, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, they're pretty pro-police union by and large. And even then, I think that their feelings are complicated. I don't really get into it in the book, but officers that I spoke to, I will say that I think the average, New York Times reading liberal probably thinks most cops are stupid. And I'm here to say, like, they're not. Like, no, they don't have, PhDs in astrophysics, but they're just like, they're workers, and they actually probably have a better understanding of some issues than someone who only reads about them does. Some of them are indeed like not like the sharpest tools in the shed, but you could say that about just about any profession for what it's worth. They understand that their outcomes are tied to the union's effectiveness, even if they don't agree with some of the political stances the union might take. And so they understand, like, look, like, these are the people that are on our side who are arguing for our overtime. They're the ones arguing for our vacation policy. They're the ones looking out for us from a labor perspective. And so if on the way to doing that, they are like saying whatever on Twitter, like, I think for an officer, they're much more concerned about results than about what the political statement of the union head happens to be, or if they even like the union head. And some of even not in the cities that I was in, but here locally, have talked about like not liking the personality of the union head, who happens to be like they say is like very self-interested or whatever else, right? But just because you are pro-police union and that you are a union-represented person doesn't mean that you are like pro-union writ large. I don't have any clear evidence that police officers are particularly class conscious. I don't think that they, to any really strong degree, associate their struggles with the struggle of, say, ununionized DoorDash drivers. I don't think that they, by and large, see themselves as part of some common class struggle. And for what it's worth, in terms of in practice, like, is it a it's class struggle insofar as there are the hyper rich and the rest of us, but some officers are very well compensated. Some officers actually live very different lives from a factory worker or someone like an Amazon worker who's trying to unionize, or a Starbucks employee. And so I can't speak too directly to it, but at the very least, I don't have any clear evidence that officers see themselves as part of some cohesive working class movement, much less actively advocating for the liberation of, the proletariat writ large.
I don't know if Scott, anything, but before we go, again, you can tell people about your book and how they can get a hold of it and anything else you've done or anything else you want them to know.
Yeah, sure. So The Danger Imperative, Violence, Death, and the Soul of Policing is available on Amazon and anywhere else books are sold. You can also find out more information at www.dangerimperative.com. If you do pick up a copy, would love for you to leave a review on Amazon, or you could just shoot me a message. Again, that's www.dangerimperative.com.
And we'll put that in the show notes as well. Real quick for everyone else out there, check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit subscribe button. If you're listening to some of the many audio platforms we're on, give us a rate and review. And then if you really like us, go to greenandredpodcast.org and hit the support button to make a donation or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. Michael, it's been really great talking with you today. Thanks for all your work. This is actually a pretty fascinating study, like we said at the beginning.
I appreciate
And
that. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
yep, and everyone else out there, make a lot of trouble and misbehave, and we'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Thanks for having me.